Hello and welcome to the July 20th edition of the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sands of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Today's main story is Inside ICE's Largest Detention Center by Jonathan Blitzer. A reporter at large, Inside ICE's Largest Detention Center by Jonathan Blitzer. In an office park in El Paso, Texas, across the street from the Nuevo Amanir Church, is a one-story white stucco building with a scuffed metal door. A small sign decorated with a drawing of a globe hangs above the entrance, announcing the Intensive Supervision Appearance Program. ISAP, as it's known to roughly 200,000 enrollees, is an initiative of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, an alternative to detention which allows immigrants with open or unresolved legal cases to live freely while checking in with officials a few times a year. It began in 2004 with the simple premise, the federal government cannot jail everyone it might want to deport. One of the program's participants, Ray, is a Cuban in his mid-50s, who came to the U.S. in 1994. Shortly after arriving, he was involved in a robbery in Florida. He served a 5-year prison sentence, but because Cuba didn't cooperate with American authorities, he could not be deported. Instead, he was authorized to remain in the country. In 2014, Ray moved to El Paso, where he worked as a truck driver and began making regular visits to the local ISAP office. My friends would tell me, "Are you crazy? One day they're going to arrest you," he said recently. I would tell them, "If when we were young, we did things wrong, now we have to do things the right way." Ray, who is tall, heavyset, and bald, with a baritone voice, is a laid-back optimist. He and his wife, a U.S. citizen whom I'll call Sarah, met at a weekly salsa night at an El Paso bar. She was struck by his unhesitating generosity. "Ray is the kind of person who, if he has something, he'll give it to you," she said. In El Paso, Ray went on to open a Cuban pizzeria, a nightclub, and trash collection and furniture restoration businesses. "My wife calls me a dreamer," he told me. They got married a decade ago when Sarah's son was a year old. We eventually told him that Ray wasn't his biological father, but he didn't care, Sarah said. As far as he was concerned, Ray was always his dad and always would be. Last October, Ray's case manager at ISAP called and asked him to stop by for an appointment. He arrived between errands, having just taken his son to school and carrying $2,000 in his pocket, a payment for a new pizza oven. "I was running around like crazy," he said. It was also Sarah's birthday. They were supposed to meet for lunch. Ray spent a few minutes in the waiting room of the ISAP office, a drab space with bare blue and white walls and two rows of chairs, before an official summoned him inside. "Walk down that hallway," he told him. A group of ICE agents was waiting. "No one explained what was happening," Ray told me. "They put him in handcuffs and led him to a van that was loaded with people. A woman inside was sobbing as she told agents that her 3 children were currently at school. 'What are they going to do?' she asked. 'Who's going to pick them up?'" By 2 o'clock that afternoon, Sarah hadn't heard from Ray and decided to drive to the ISAP office. His car was still in the parking lot. Inside, an official gave Sarah the address of a detention center. When she got there, another official told her that family visits were conducted alphabetically by detainees' last names. She'd have to come a different day for Ray's turn. Sarah, a college graduate who works for the state of Texas, is pragmatic and personable. "You have a computer," she replied. "Can you just do me the favor of telling me if my husband is being held here?" The official refused. Sarah went to another detention center in the area, where she was told that Ray was at the place she'd just left. When she returned to the first jail, an official directed her to a side door of the building. A man in a khaki uniform emerged and handed her a Ziploc bag containing Ray's wallet, which was empty, and the shoelaces from his sneakers. A few hours later, Ray and more than a dozen other detainees were driven 10 minutes east to a facility where he would spend the next 6 weeks. It was down a long, barren drive, almost a mile from the main road, and sealed off behind a metal gate. Four large white tents stood in an imposing line, flanked by a few small buildings. The desolate surroundings scared some of the others, but Ray, whose pizzeria was nearby, recognized where they were, at a military base called Fort Bliss. Last summer, the Trump administration picked Fort Bliss to be the site of the largest detention center in the country. ICE was ramping up arrests nationwide, and the government, in search of more space to hold people, opted to erect tents, known in government parlance as soft-sided facilities, at military installations and close to existing ICE jails. The idea seemed to be, how can we do this as cheaply and brutally as possible? Claire Trickler McNulty, a former senior ICE official, told me, Fort Bliss's proximity to the U.S.-Mexico border and its considerable size made it an obvious place to start. It also had a loaded history. During the Second World War, 56 U.S. citizens and residents of Japanese, German, and Italian descent were interned on the premises as enemy aliens. ICE already had a detention center nearby on Montana Avenue. The agency called the new installation a sprawling tent complex that could hold up to 5,000 people, Camp East Montana. The contract for running Camp East Montana was worth more than $1 billion. Initially, the Department of Defense awarded it to Deployed Resources, a logistics contractor that had operated tent facilities during the Biden administration. But the decision was almost immediately reversed. The Trump administration claimed that it had canceled the contract for technical reasons. Current and former ICE officials, however, told me that Deployed Resources had landed on a no-contract list because of its past association with the Biden White House. Among other things, one of the company's board members was married to a former chief of staff of Doug Emhoff, Kamala Harris's husband. A few weeks later, the contract went out to a second time, and 11 companies placed bids. On July 18th, the Army announced the winner, a Virginia-based firm called Acquisition Logistics, which had no prior detention experience. The largest federal contract it had previously received, a $16 million commission for program management at a California naval base, was a fraction of the new project. Public databases listed between 8 and 50 employees at the company, and the firm's official address was a modest gray house with red shutters in the suburbs of Richmond, which belonged to the company's founder and CEO, Kenneth Wagner, a 78-year-old Navy veteran. Wagner's 60-page bid offered little more than a rhetorical embrace of the administration's immigration policies. Any misstep by inexperienced contractors can be detrimental, creating political fodder that detracts from, challenges, and slows down the exceptional work of ICE, the proposal stated. Later, other government contractor filed a lawsuit claiming that Acquisition Logistics had failed to meet at least two of the bid's solicitation requirements. The Army responded in writing that the contract was consistent with a recent executive order titled Protecting the American People Against Invasion, and that any further delay would directly exacerbate the existing detention capacity crisis. The scramble to ready the facility led to a string of other irregularities and mishaps. Flouting state legal requirements, Acquisition Logistics failed to register to operate in Texas, according to research by the nonprofit group called Public Citizen. On July 21st, a 38-year-old construction worker named Hector Gonzalez was crushed to death by falling building materials. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration later found three subcontractors responsible. One of them was owned by Nathan Albers, a Trump campaign donor who spent election night in 2024 at Mar-a-Lago. His companies had a raft of prior infractions, according to ProPublica, ranging from employing undocumented workers to violating minimum wage and overtime laws. The first detainees who were taken to Camp East Montana in early August arrived at an active construction site. They were kept awake at night by the sound of trucks and jackhammers. During the day, plumes of dust blanketed the facility. "This place does not seem to be designed for humans to be here," a Venezuelan father of two from Dallas told the American Civil Liberties Union in a sworn declaration. On August 4th, Representative Veronica Escobar, a Democrat from El Paso, made a formal request to visit the facility. "We tried to get in as soon as we learned that they were already holding detainees," she told me. "Although members of Congress are by law allowed to inspect detention facilities, ICE denied Escobar's request. In an email, officials told her that the site was still under construction and will not be operational until August 17th. But, as the Washington Post later reported, 15 people were already being held there. "It was definitely earlier than anticipated, including by the contractors," an administration official told me. "The 17th is what we were expecting internally. Then ICE just brought some people." The lack of preparation made the conditions intolerable. Toilets wouldn't flush. Running water came sporadically. The detainees ate and slept next to the bathrooms. Fetid water leaked into the dining area and under the beds. "Since we are not given anything to mop up the dirty water, we had to use our own underwear and socks," a Cuban detainee said. He had pleaded with the guards to let him and the others go outside for recreation. 15 days passed before the men were allowed to leave the tent, and then only at night. "I have not seen the sun for approximately 1 month," he said. The outdoor spaces hadn't been finished. Neither had the areas for visitation. Phone booths for making calls weren't yet set up, and tablets that detainees were given to call their lawyers didn't work. Most of the people inside had been transferred from the South Florida Detention Facility, another tent complex, which the government proudly called Alligator Alcatraz. But for most of August, they were effectively off the grid. ICE's detainee locator, which allows family members and lawyers to see where someone is being held, issued an error message for those who were now at Camp East Montana. "This was seemingly by design," the administration official told me. "The system was generally supposed to show where a person was being held within 72 hours of his arrival at a new facility." Somewhat at ICE, the official said, went in and changed the settings and made it say, "Call ICE for details." By the time Ray arrived in October, there had been so many complaints about conditions at Camp East Montana that both ICE and the Government Accountability Office sent teams to conduct site visits. "The physical layout was a disaster," one of the officials who visited told me. "A tent that was supposed to provide space for a barbershop, a law library, and religious services was closed because workers were using it as a staging area while they erected another tent to house more detainees." According to a GAO report, ICE officials were unaware of many of these problems because the agency hadn't inspected the facility before it started sending detainees there. This itself was a breach of ICE policy. The cells in the so-called special housing unit, or SHU, which were used for solitary confinement, had features that the officials said would make it easier for someone in distress to commit suicide. A handle on the door, a beam within reach of the bed. The cameras in that area still didn't work. "You're just putting people who are depressed and being kept alone in a room and who, by the way, have nothing to do. There was zero activity. The tablets didn't work. They never got to go outside. No books, no games, no TV. You're leaving them in there, and you're not watching them, the official said. When we left, we told our leadership that someone was going to kill himself. When Sarah learned that Ray had been sent to Camp East Montana, she tried to comfort herself with the thought that her husband was a survivor. In 1994, at the age of 21, he was one of some 35,000 Cubans who fled the island for the United States on makeshift rafts. Hundreds drowned attempting the trip. It was the peak of a decades-long crisis which Fidel Castro, the country's leader, called the Periodo Especial, a bald euphemism for the economic collapse that occurred in Cuba after the fall of its patron, the Soviet Union. 10 people from Ray's neighborhood in Havana, including his older half-brother, were on his raft, which they had fashioned from a tractor tire. There were moments when you really didn't know if you were going north or if you were going the wrong way back to Cuba, he told me. At one point on the open sea, a smaller raft that had started to leak floated over, and a mother begged them to take her 10-year-old son. Ray and the others agreed, though they had to threaten the adults on the other raft not to jump aboard theirs, since the added weight would sink them all. The U.S. Coast Guard eventually intercepted Ray's raft, and he was taken to the American Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where he spent the next 11 months. For much of that time, he couldn't communicate with his mother, who had stayed behind in Havana, or with his father, who lived in El Paso. Guantanamo, he told me, turned into a city where you had to make your own way. He and his friends banded together to fend off attacks from other internees. The men in Ray's group would chaperone the women around the base, watching the door when they used the bathroom. The biggest challenge, he said, was that you didn't know when you'd be able to leave. In the end, Ray was sent to live with his father in El Paso, but their relationship became tense, and he moved to Miami, where he had friends from Havana. These were wayward years. He took odd jobs and lived in a cramped apartment with roommates. He got arrested while driving a car full of stolen goods. After half a decade in prison, he returned to El Paso, where he briefly lived with a half-sister, before striking out on his own. As a former internee at Guantanamo and a one-time federal inmate, Ray had enough experience to be immediately alarmed by the chaos at Camp East Montana. There was no formal intake process for new arrivals and no orientation to explain how things worked. When the guards took Ray's cash, he asked them for an official receipt listing the amount. They told him not to worry. "Of course I'm worried," he said. "It's $2,000. Ray has diabetes and high blood pressure. He took a battery of medications, including 2 separate pills for diabetes and an antibiotic to address an earlier infection, all of which were at home with Sarah. He tried to tell a guard about his medical conditions. "Here's my wife's number," he said. "Please call her." The guard replied, "We're not going to be doing that." Ray spent his first night sleeping on the floor of a cell, holding with 20 other men. "You didn't have a blanket. It was cold, and you were hungry," he said. "I could begin to feel the coldness of a prison." Every tent at Camp East Montana was divided into a dozen units, each containing about 35 bunk beds, topped with thin pallets. When Ray was transferred from the holding cell to Tent C, he asked which bed was his. "Whatever one you find empty," he was told. Ray knew more about his rights than the average detainee, and he tended to ask pointed questions. How could he make his first phone call? "It's with a tablet," the guard replied. But to access the tablet, each detainee needed a PIN, and it could take up to a week for a PIN to be issued. During that time, my family won't know where I am, Ray asked. Exactly, the guard replied. One of the ironies of a facility was that, for an ICE jail, actual ICE officers were scarce. Instead, the detainees interacted with private contractors from multiple companies. Loyal Source was responsible for medical care. Amentum managed logistics from IT to housing. The security guards who were employed by Akima Global Services were distinguishable by the color of their shirts. One night, Ray was laying in bed when an older man in a wheelchair entered the tent. The unit was nearly full, and the only empty spaces were on the top bunks. Ray walked over to a guard to say that the man in the wheelchair needed help finding a place to sleep. The guard shrugged. "It always come back to the same thing," Ray told me. They weren't prepared. Somebody eventually tossed the man a mattress pad, and he slept on the floor. Without his medication, Ray often felt dizzy and weak. The guards told him to submit a formal request to see a doctor. He did so, but days passed without a response. He began to have trouble urinating, which was especially concerning. 3 months earlier, he'd been hospitalized with a similar problem that had led to sepsis, and doctors had inserted a catheter. "Sincerely, these are simple things," he told me, "but the system turned them into something grave." One morning in early November, after Ray had been in detention for about a week, the guards ordered everyone in his unit to go outside to the yard while the staff cleaned the tent. Ray refused to leave his bed. A high-ranking official came over and demanded to know what the problem was. "My reason is very simple," Ray said. "I'm diabetic. I need my medicine." The guard replied, "I understand, but tomorrow we'll resolve your problem. Right now, you need to leave the unit." Ray complied, but the next day nothing happened. The following week, he once more refused to leave his bed during the cleaning. "You again," the guard said. "No, it's you again," Ray replied. "You told me one thing, and nada. Don't waste your time with me. If you want to send me to the hole, do it. But I need my medicine. My wife is outside, very worried, and all I'm asking for is my medicine." Ray spent the next 8 hours in the shoe. Afterward, he was sent back to his tent without any medication. "Look," one of the guards told him, "we now understand what type of medicine you need, but we don't have it here. We have to order it, and it's a whole process." On a warm evening this April, I drove to the El Paso Service Processing Center, one of the city's main immigration jails, for visiting hours. The person I'd come to see, Antonio Ascon Frometa, had much in common with Ray. Frometa had also come to the U.S. from Cuba in 1994 during the Rafter crisis. Like Ray, he had spent time at Guantanamo before ending up in Florida, where during the next 3 decades, he started a family and worked as a landscaper. He is 64 years old and trim, with bushy eyebrows, a full head of gray hair, and a lined face. Dressed in a loose-fitting red uniform, he picked up the phone in the visitation booth and looked at me through a plexiglass divider with an expression of distrust. I hadn't told him that I was coming. Frometa had been detained for the previous 8 months following his arrest last August in an immigration raid in West Palm Beach. "I didn't try to run," he told me. "I wasn't even arrested by ICE. It was by someone from the Florida Highway Patrol." He was promptly transferred to the South Florida Detention Facility, Alligator Alcatraz, where a guard punched him so hard in his right ear that he can no longer hear out of it. He was still nursing the injury when ICE sent him to Camp East Montana. He arrived in late August. Everything was covered in dust, he said. They were building more tents. The nights were cold, and his ear throbbed. A few weeks later, he bumped into someone he'd met decades earlier at Guantanamo. The man's name was Geraldo Lunas Campos. He didn't recognize me at first, but I recognized him, Frometa told me. Lunas Campos had been living in Rochester, New York, with his three children. He had served prison time in the U.S., 5 years for attempting to sell drugs, and 1 year for having sexual contact with an individual under 11, which Carrie Lunas, one of his daughters, has said was the result of an unfounded claim made during an acrimonious divorce. His criminal record led ICE to arrest him last July. Lunas Campos arrived at Camp Montana East in September, about a month after Frometa. The two struck up their friendship. I knew members of Geraldo's family, Frometa said. Lunas Campos was asthmatic and used an inhaler. He also suffered from bipolar disorder, depression, and anxiety. A report obtained by ProPublica stated that during his time at Camp East Montana, he'd explained at least 8 times about missing doses of antipsychotic drugs that he took for his conditions. At one point, he'd given himself a black eye, the result of banging his head against a wall. In October, guards found him with a bedsheet tied around his neck, threatening suicide. On January 2nd, as Frometa later stated in a sworn declaration, he saw Geraldo ask the guards the whole day for his asthma medicine. The guards ignored him, but Lunas Campos pleaded with them again the following day, knocking on the door of the guard station to get their attention. "We'll take you to the hole," one of the guards threatened, to which Lunas Campos replied, "You can take me to the hole, but just give me my medicine." That was the last time Frometa saw him. The next morning, he called Lunas Campos' wife to check in. Frometa was the only other detainee at Camp East Montana who had her phone number. She told him that ICE had just called her to say that her husband woke up dead, Frometa told me. She said they wanted to cremate the body, and I told her to wait to investigate. 6 days after Lunas Campos died, ICE issued a statement saying the guards had observed him in distress and that his death was under investigation. A week later, the Washington Post reported that El Paso's County Office of the Medical Examiner, which had performed an autopsy, was planning to classify the incident as a homicide, citing as the cause of death asphyxiation due to neck and chest compression. At this point, ICE revised its previous statement. It now claimed that Lunas Campos had violently resisted the security staff and continued to attempt to take his life. The Government Accountability Office later found that evidence associated with the incident was missing or destroyed. To date, at least 5 other witnesses have contradicted the government's version of the events. The special housing unit where Lunas Campos had been taken that night was in a smaller tent on the south side of the facility. Inside, each cell had a toilet and a bed and was covered by wire netting, presumably to prevent escape. About 25 men were held there at a time, most because they complained about conditions at the facility. The other inmates could easily hear what was happening in Lunas Campos's cell. Santos Jesus Flores, a Salvadoran who was in the SHU that night, said in a declaration that Lunas Campos's hands and feet had been cuffed. He'd heard Lunas Campos begging for his medicine, followed soon afterward by the sounds of the guards punching Geraldo, the clanking of Geraldo's handcuffs, the sound of shoes scraping against the floor. Then I heard Geraldo saying, "I have asthma, I can't breathe." Flores's account is consistent with that of Ricardo Andrade Mosquera, a 29-year-old from Venezuela, who was in another nearby cell. They were on top of him, he told the El Paso Times. He screamed horribly as they hit him. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Now continuing on. Lunas Campos's death was the second of three that occurred at the facility between December 3, 2025 and January 14, 2026. Francisco Gaspar Andreas, a 48-year-old from Guatemala, had received medical treatment at Camp East Montana for nearly 2 months before he was transferred to a local hospital, where he died of liver and kidney failure. Victor Manuel Diaz, a 36-year-old Nicaraguan who was arrested while working at a Korean barbecue restaurant in Coon Rapids, Minnesota, died 7 days after being transferred to Camp East Montana on January 7th in what ICE said was a presumed suicide. Diaz had previously got sick while working on a dairy farm and spent 2 months in a hospital with tuberculosis. He'd been fighting hard in the hospital to get better, his ex-wife, who lives in the U.S., told me. He was finally out and working. It doesn't make sense that he would have committed suicide. This time, unlike with Lunas Campos's death, the autopsy was conducted at Fort Bliss. The deaths were accompanied by a growing number of reports about abuse inside Camp East Montana. Between August 2025 and January 2026, 130 calls to 911 were made from the facility, according to the Associated Press. In at least six of them, detainees said that they were considering suicide. Omar Ram Singh, a Dutch-born green card holder who was detained at Camp East Montana before being deported to the Netherlands this year, told the AP that he overheard guards betting up to $500 on which detainee would next kill himself. The Department of Homeland Security denied Ram Singh's account. Every day felt like a week. Every week felt like a month. Every month felt like a year, he said. Camp East Montana was 1,000% worse than a prison. Lunas Campos's children, who are U.S. citizens, have filed a lawsuit in federal court. Many of the witnesses, including Fermetta and Flores, have said that ICE has tried to punish them for speaking out. Flores lost his ability to make phone calls after his PIN was abruptly suspended. The government deported Mosquera to Mexico, where he was arrested by Mexican authorities because he didn't have legal papers to be in the country. Guards had already been pressuring Frometa to agree to be deported to Mexico. After he spoke with a journalist from the Washington Post, one guard told him that unless he went to Mexico, he would be locked up in this facility for my entire life. Still, Frometa refused. I'm Cuban, not Mexican, he told me. In February, Frometa was transferred to the El Paso Service Processing Center. When I visited him there 2 months later, a battered manila folder containing a stack of legal documents that he'd filled for himself sat on his side of the divider. ICE had refused to release him on bond. Afterward, we continued to speak on the phone. By July, he was still being detained, which both angered and baffled him. I've lived in the U.S. for 32 years, he told me. What is the danger I pose to society? Why am I still here? Sarah and Ray's house is about 45 minutes away from Camp East Montana. Visiting the facility, which Sarah did every day, took hours, but the commute was the least of her travails. Walking through the door was like entering a different dimension, she told me. Outside, the guards were often genial and chatty. Inside, visitors were treated as objects of suspicion, barked at and insulted. The gate was like a portal, like something out of Narnia, she went on. It's a different world that you enter. It transforms you. If a visitor arrived during the detainee roll call, which happened in the mornings and evenings, but at no set times, It could be 2 or 3 hours before visitation resumed. I live here at least, Sarah told me. But there were people from New York, Minnesota, Boston, Florida, and other parts of Texas. There was nowhere comfortable to wait at the facility, so the families of detainees often gathered at a nearby McDonald's. Sarah showed other visitors how to download an app called Getting Out, which allowed relatives to communicate with people on the inside. The app charged both the person sending a message and the one receiving it. There was also a limited number of characters allowed in each message. Ray and Sarah developed a shorthand to save space and money. TQM meant Te Quiero Mucho. TXMEQ was an abbreviation for Text Me at 9. Every tablet was shared among 5 detainees, and the men inside Ray's unit created a rough schedule for themselves. Ray reserved 2 slots a day to align with his son's routine, one in the morning to talk to him before school, and the other at night before bedtime. On 2 occasions, his son came with Sarah for an in-person visit. They were separated by a tall divide. Conversations at the booths blended together. "We are not a family that speaks softly," Sarah said, "but even we couldn't hear each other." A small circle in the divider meant the voices to carry across it, but it was so hard to hear that Sarah had to put her ear against the plexiglass to make out the words. The effect was a bizarre choreography in which it was virtually impossible to look at Ray when he was speaking. Either she heard him or she saw him, but never both at the same time. In the background, electronic timers meant to enforce a 1-hour limit for visitors in each booth went off cacophonously, adding to the general din. Ray was haggard and unshaven, and he was losing weight rapidly. "The deterioration was steady," Sarah told me. She got a doctor to write a note to the facility's authorities specifying the medications he needed. With the help of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, a local legal services group, she eventually recovered Reyes's $2,000. But ICE was immovable when it came to his medical care. The problem wasn't just the lack of a response. It was that they denied he was sick, she told me. They told him his blood pressure was fine, but they made no record. I can't tell you if they did any of what they said. Ray hid his growing distress from her son. There wasn't enough room in the visitation booth for both Sarah and their son to sit in chairs facing him, so they alternated with one crouching on the floor. Ray invented elaborate stories for the boy, often describing soccer games that he and the other detainees played in the yard. He left happy as long as he knew that his father was okay, Sarah told me. The ICE officials who regularly appeared at Camp East Montana are called deportation officers. Officially, their job is to make sure that detainees with final orders of removal are deported. Unofficially, they often pressured those without orders to agree to be deported anyway. The officers were aided in the second task by the conditions at the camp. Many detainees with valid or pending legal claims simply couldn't stand to be here any longer. But the deportation officers also had other means of persuading the holdouts. According to testimony given to the ACLU by multiple detainees from Cuba, the officers would periodically handcuff those who refused to be deported and drive them to remote stretches along the Mexican border. Buses with masked men, presumably agents from Mexico, waited on the other side. I started yelling and screaming at the immigration guard in Mexico that this is a kidnapping, a 51-year-old Cuban man from Florida said. Out of the 13 people who came with me on the bus, only 4 people returned with me. Every few days, an officer showed up in Reyes's tent to ask if he was ready to sign a document acceding to his deportation. "Are you staying or are you leaving?" he'd ask Ray flatly. For weeks, Ray waved the officer away, but he was spending hours each day in bed with debilitating headaches. He could barely urinate, and he had lost about 30 pounds. "I couldn't even tell you if there was a medical tent at the facility," he said. "I just didn't understand how, in an immigration detention center, they can't give you any medicine. Not only that, how is it that I can't see a doctor?" One day in December, the deportation officer made his regular visit, asking his customary questions. "What about my medicine?" Ray asked him. The officer replied, "I didn't come to talk about your medicine. I'm not interested in your medicine. I'm with ICE. Either you're leaving or you're staying." By then, Ray had met other detainees who'd been at Camp East Montana for even longer than he had, 3, 4, 5 months. "What would happen," he asked Sarah later that day, "if his blood pressure dropped and he needed to be hospitalized? Would the same people who refused to give him medicine call an ambulance?" "I could last a couple of weeks without medicine," he said, "but I don't want to die here." Afterward, he told the guard that he was ready to sign the papers. "In less than 72 hours, I was already in Mexico," he told me. "You realize that when they want to do something quickly, they do it." At around 5:45 a.m. on January 12th, Lydia, a 49-year-old mother and grandmother from Mexico, was driving to work in Minnesota when she noticed a dark car in the rearview mirror. On her phone, she was connected via Zoom to a daily prayer session that she and her husband held with a group of nuns. The car behind her suddenly flashed its lights and signaled for her to pull over. Looking again, Lydia saw that it wasn't a single car, but two. Men emerged in ICE vests. Lydia told the others on Zoom, "Hermanitas, I'm getting snatched." Lydia and her husband came to Minnesota in 2003 with their 1-year-old daughter, Erdrana. They were undocumented and took cleaning jobs, working night shifts. The couple eventually had two boys, now ages 12 and 21. Lydia, her husband, and their sons lived in a tidy mobile home about 30 miles northwest of Minneapolis. A few houses down, Adrena, who'd obtained a form of legal protection through Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, lived with her partner and their two boys, an infant and a toddler. The evening before Lydia was pulled over, the whole family had met at Adrana's house with the notary public. The Trump administration had recently launched Operation Metro Surge, in which more than 3,000 federal agents were deployed in roving patrols across Minnesota to make immigration arrests. Lydia and her husband gave power of attorney to their older son, Alexis, as did Adrena and her partner, an undocumented immigrant from Jalisco. Alexis was the only one in the family who was both a U.S. citizen and a legal adult. "It scares me that something might happen," Lydia's husband had told her. The prospect of getting separated made him cry. Lydia replied, "We have to be strong. If something happens to you, I'll have to get you out. If something happens to me, I want you to be strong with our kids." They took an inventory of assets to liquidate: cars, TVs, furniture. Relatives in Mexico were put on alert in case a member of the family was deported. None of them expected that their plans would be tested quite so soon. Lydia's husband had logged on to the prayer Zoom from work. He immediately called Alexis, who rushed over in his car to try to intercede. Lydia had been stopped just a few miles from their home. "I'm a member of the National Guard," Alexis told the agents when he arrived. He didn't have time to explain that about a year earlier, his mother had applied for a special type of legal parole tied to his service. Instead, he hugged her and said, Do not sign anything. For the next 2 hours, while the agents made more arrests, Lydia sat cuffed at her wrists and ankles in the back of a van that had been disguised to look like a construction vehicle, with ladders, fluorescent vests, and tools displayed in the front window. The van was parked in the lot of a Lutheran church across the street from where she'd been pulled over. Eventually, Lydia was taken to an ICE field office where she was able to call Alexis. He told her that the family was contacting an immigration lawyer. Later that evening, Lydia and a group of other detainees were boarded onto a bus and driven to an airport tarmac. "They're bringing us to Mexico," someone said. Another person replied, "But I'm not from Mexico." The plane touched down after dark, and everyone was ordered onto another bus. When they got out, about 20 minutes later, they could barely see anything. Lydia struggled to make out what looked like a row of enormous white tents. "Is this prison?" she asked an ICE officer. "Where are we?" "This is El Paso, Texas," he said. Seven other women arrived at Camp East Montana with Lydia, and together they were taken to Unit 4 of a tent called ECO. It was the last of the structures to go up at the facility, and ICE used it primarily to house people arrested in Operation Metro Surge. Not everyone in Lydia's group was from Minnesota, however. One couple lived in Chicago and had been vacationing in the state when they were arrested. Another woman from Wisconsin had gone to Minnesota to watch her son's soccer team play a match. There were about 80 women in the unit that Lydia joined, some of whom had already spent several weeks there. "Most people had Hispanic last names," Lydia told me. It would be another 3 weeks before she was given a physical exam and formally registered as a detainee. During that time, she wore the clothes that she was arrested in. It was cold, and Lydia went everywhere in her jacket, including to bed each night. The detainees were not permitted to leave their unit, even for recreation. They ate at their communal tables or on their beds. Two TVs blared late into the evening. Those who could block out the noise slept in the glow. Lydia didn't pay much attention to several women with hacking coughs until she came down with COVID. A sign had been placed outside their unit to alert guards of a COVID outbreak, but Lydia and the others couldn't see it. Lydia's symptoms eased after a few days, and she began helping clean the unit's bathrooms, scrubbing toilets with the toothbrush, squares of toilet paper, and leftover bits of shampoo. The women worked in shifts because the staff never came to clean. Security guards sometimes offered the women cookies if they agreed to clean the dormitories themselves. This appeared to be one of the starker realities of the eco tent. Even by the low standards of Camp East Montana, detainees who'd been arrested in Minnesota were subject to an exceptional level of neglect, as though the unbridled spirit of Operation Metro Surge had carried over to West Texas. At least once a day, however, an ICE officer would peek in to ask who was ready to sign the papers authorizing their deportation. Lydia told me that at least half the women in her unit eventually acquiesced. She repeated Alexis's instructions like a mantra, "I won't sign, I won't sign." It was a week before she spoke to her family, who were facing their own struggles as a result of Operation Metro Surge. Adriana's DACA status no longer seemed to afford much protection. She and her partner were afraid to leave the house. They waited until 1 in the morning to take the trash out. Volunteers with an organization called Mobile Hope dropped off food, diapers, and other household items. Lydia's husband continued to go to work. He and Alexis woke up each morning just after 3 and left before sunrise, around 4. Alexis would drive in a separate car ahead of him to make sure that the roads were clear of agents. During calls with Lydia, the family was careful not to burden her with these details. Lydia had told them, "You can't cry because then I will cry and then I won't be able to talk." One morning in January, Lydia and the other women in Unit 4 were told that a member of Congress was coming to visit. "Be sure to look pretty," one of the guards told them. The visitor, it turned out, was a staffer for Veronica Escobar. The congresswoman had also been making regular visits to Camp East Montana, despite the agency's best efforts to stymie her. "I had to sue twice in order to get in," Escobar told me. On some occasion, she gave the local ICE office advance warning that she would be visiting, only to learn that her plans had been leaked. Sure enough, the local GOP and some of the extremists who live in El Paso had shared the notice of my overnight visit, she said. There was only one way that they would have known that the date and the time of my visit, and that's if ICE had shared that with them. The El Paso County Republican Party denied this, saying that it had heard about the congresswoman's upcoming visit through the grapevine. Several weeks later, Escobar's staffer, who had previously entered the facility without incident, was identified by ICE and pilloried on Fox News for, according to the agency, trying to gain entry by falsely claiming to be a lawyer. "It has become a political operation," Escobar said. Nevertheless, the conditions in the camp improved slightly after the staffer's visit. The women